Check out shipshape.pro for more episodes and bonus content.
Today on the Ship Shape podcast, we have Marius Popa. He's been in the marine industry for some time. He's been naval architect. He's in the energy scene. He's a visionary. And welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for your invitation and for a very nice introduction.
Where are you recording this from?
I'm now in Aberdeen, Scotland. Aberdeen is now my home city. However, I was born in Romania, somewhere close to Danube Delta.
So, you know, one of the interesting things about your story is that you started off in like essentially communism behind the Iron Curtain. And through your career, you've been able to travel and now you're out in Aberdeen. So going back to the beginning, what really got you into the maritime space to begin with?
From my point of view, it's simple, but probably it will sound complicated. My native city, as I says already, it's on the termination or the starting, depending on the direction of the Danube Delta. And it also pretty much the most upper point of the maritime Danube. From this point of view, my city, Galați, has an old shipyard dated back in at the end of the 19th century, and obviously the related industry. Now the shipyard is owned by the Damen Group, and there are rumors that it's considered one of the best in the group. And in the communist time, communists decided to have in this city both the university the naval architecture section of the university, a local university, but what was unique in Romania in that moment, and also the research institute for ships, let's put it like this. Also, in time, this was the place where the first and probably the last offshore rigs, Romanian offshore rigs, have been built. They were pretty much the designs were Americans, you see, and pretty much the communists bought the designs and they did the execution in the shipyard in this city. So when I had to decide what university I have to go, it was in the last years of the communist time. I have to say that my first option or selection was automatization. It was called it in that moment in Romania. It was something regarding computers and fancy things. I was quite performant, had very good performance with mathematics, good enough on physics and so on. But my parents told me that they cannot really support me in Bucharest, in the capital city where this university was placed. Yeah. Communist time, it was very difficult, really, where communist people assumed that if you are a full-time student, you cannot really work at the same time. So it was very difficult to make some pocket money or to support myself. So I says, okay, let's stay home. And at that moment, I says, what is the most prestigious discipline in my city? And it was this. Okay, it was another alternative, but let's put like this. It was more related to chemistry and food and things like that. And it was not exactly my bread and butter, you see. So I competed there, and pretty much I entered the top of the list for naval architecture, but second on the on the big picture. And in this way, I entered naval architecture there. I have to say that I fall in love slowly.
Yeah.
So it was not exactly a love at first sight. It was, right, as I told you, more a matter of prestige rather than love.
Yeah,
but I cannot say that it was also an arranged marriage, because nobody forced me to enter it. It was pure my decision. Again, it was really a matter of prestige. But I entered there and I fall in love slowly, slowly. This also due to some excellent professors, teachers.
Right. I just want to say for those people who might not be too knowledgeable about it, because I don't think we should assume everyone has the same knowledge. Is there any chance you could just tell us what naval architecture actually is? Because I think people probably have a good understanding of engineering, but I'm not sure that everyone would actually know what naval architecture is. So could you give us the idiot's guide, please?
Yes. When somebody is asking me about this, because amazingly, I got tons of these questions back in time in Romania, but now in Scotland as well. I'm telling them that basically I know about ships. Is the simple answer. Okay, probably I should say I know about things what are floating, because could be ships, could be rigs, yeah. Could be various things. And I'm, to be honest, I'm very sincere about this, you see, because in reality, strictly speaking, the naval architect would be really what the architect is in civil engineering.
Yeah.
You see, so is the guy who really, or sorry, I apologize, the person, she or he, no, really, you see, because they are amazing talents in all direction of the spectrum, you see.
Yeah,
yeah. So is that professional what really imagine an amazing construction or assembly or whatever you want to call it, and is doing its own, his, her own best to materialize this construction, but it's on the very top of the process.
Yeah,
you see, and from many points of view, has to delegate a lot of tasks to other professionals. You see, so I agree that architect has to take into account, let's say, the limitation of the actual construction technologies. You see. And probably will do some kind of high-level calculations or something like this. But I think that the detailed calculation, the very detailed calculation about strength, for example, are done really by the builder, by the constructor, specialized in concrete or specialized on steels or specialized on, I don't know, chains, glass or something like this. The same also when it comes about systems, about piping, air conditioner, things like this. By the letter, the naval architect will be that group of people at the beginning of the project what are really putting together the big aspects of the ship.
Yeah.
You see, for example, one big aspect of the ship is the compartments, how the vessel will be divided, you see.
Yeah.
It's a lot of a thing to be done here, because it's depending on the function of the vessel, depending what space are needed for various functions or roles, you see. So how much cargo you want to carry, what type of equipment you will have. The dimension of the equipment will depend on the energetic solution on board, on how much speed do we like, you see, to have. On at the end of the day, what vendor you'll select. You yeah. see, so if they are able to do something tiny, or they will come with something bulky, you see, yeah. what money you have available and all of this. So through the pure naval architect are that team what are doing what it's called the basic concept of the ship. I have to say that their decision are tremendously important, because a mistake in that moment could have huge consequences for the entire life of the vessel. I'm not saying only building, I'm saying everything after.
I've Absolutely. Seen some episodes. There was this TV show out here in America, it's called Sea Disasters, and one of them was that essentially there would be a wave, and when the big cargo container got right on top of the wave, in which pretty much all of the weight was in one point, the ship would just snap.
Yes.
And there was, I think it was something to do with like poor welding or something that eventually gave way, but I'm not really sure.
In your situation, you see, I don't want to comment that this is a standard case for longitudinal strength, however, could go wrong really could be manufacturing troubles. But regarding this, it's a very interesting aspect, what I'm continuing to tell people. In 2005, the larger container carriers, they were in the range of 10,000 units, TEU. And the vessel was the standard vessel with the surface structure positioned aft. And makes a lot of sense because it will be a wide deck there in the middle, you see, so a lot of containers will be there and so on and so on. So they were already some solutions where the superstructure, but this type of vessel suffered exactly from what you says, and suffered a lot, much more than an oil tanker, for example, because it's an open section, how we call it. And the open section also have torsion problems on diagonal waves and things like that. And due to this, for example, top of the hatch combings, the longitudinal hatch combings, were going to thicker and thicker and stronger materials. I remember from my junior years surveying in shipyards, welding of 80 millimeters, 100 millimeters thick plates, what it's a nightmare. And high stencil steel, very difficult to weld, a lot of cracks after and things like that. And suddenly in that moment when people were looking to solution to sort out this, I remember that a certain, let's not call, not name nations or companies or something like this, but let's put like this, a certain nation from Asia, the engineers from there, they says that they developed it, an amazing steel, what was really arresting the cracks. Majority of the engineers, they were... You see, a little bit doubtful about this, but the names in discussion there, they were quite great. And we says, okay, maybe it's like this. But the idea, the bottom line was, and the really the jump to larger vessels was not due to fancy materials or things like that. But the jump to larger vessel was then when a naval architect understood the nature of the problem and pretty much took the superstructure and the bunkering spaces and all of this and start to rearrange with a lot of gravity, you see, with a lot of courage, rearranging all of this to the middle of the vessel in such a way that if something like this will happen, the bending of the vessel, what will bend the vessel like this, won't be maybe so like this, won't be so bad, let's put it like this. By doing this cleverly, we have now vessel of 24,000 TEU. So when you look to the modern, very large container carriers, you'll see that the superstructure is not anymore at the aft part or in the aft third. It's really in the middle. Also by doing this, the torsion problem was mitigated, was made smaller. Anyhow, these are details, but this, for example, emphasizes, in my personal opinion, the importance of the naval architect. And the naval architect or the group of naval architects having that idea, in my opinion, I can only applaud and says, yes, they did a notch in the history of naval architecture.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about naval architecture, because my background is in yachting and I've interviewed, you know, yacht designers and all the rest of it. And I think yacht designers get a lot more credit than the naval architects, especially in the yachting industry. There's a lot more attention given to them because what they do is so visible and also easier to explain. It's easier to explain yacht design, I think, probably. But without the naval architect, you know, you're absolutely stuffed, aren't you? You know, it's something that really has to take plenty of time and concentration.
Now depends what you understand by yachting. If you understand by yachting a reasonable, a small, I apologize for using small, but as you can observe, for me, a boat start probably on 70 meters is still small. You see? But yeah. For a small boat, what is designed eventually with sails, you see, what is designed for, I will call it speed and leisure. I think that the most important there is the shape, what will give the speed, what will give eventually stability. Yeah, because stability, it's also a matter for war. In my opinion, it's a big matter for something like this. But the leisure will come, in my opinion, from the direct exposure to the current, the air current coming from speed. You see, rather from the direct exposure coming from rain or from ugly cold wind there. What I want to say here is the fact that really what it's inside in that boat the compartmentation, the spaces, the utilities, and things like that, what, yeah, in a way will fell in to the naval architect. Okay, naval architect takes care also about the shape. Okay, still a specialist will have the last decision there, or not the last, it will come with the proposals, you see. But I'm trying to say that maybe the focus here, it's completely in other things. When it comes about the yachts, like we are seeing now in news about the yachts of the multimillionaires from a certain part of the world now in conflict with another part of the world, what are or they are not arrested in different parts of the world, you see, something like this. That yachts are completely other discussion. So leisure there, it's completely in other format.
That gets to another good point. So when you look at the maritime industry, right, because I'm coming from the leisure marine and Georgia is coming from super yachts, leisure marine didn't really start until kind of like the late 50s, 60s. And it's a relatively new thing. But where you're coming from, there's a whole heritage that goes back hundreds of years. And so it's a unique type of experience. When I was doing some background research on the companies that you've worked for in the past, you know, some of them were going in the 1800s, you know.
Lloyd's is the oldest one, going end of the 1790 something or 80 something. And the history of how these companies emerged, it's also an amazing social and economical history. Yeah, I don't know if we have time to discuss all of this. Yeah, but I agree with you. You see, I want to tell you something. It's a very wise and old, apparently, Chinese word. What says that for the potter, the most important is the pot. For the merchandiser, the most important is the emptiness of the pot. So this is bringing you the two different perspectives in discussions here. And the beauty, the magic, is to overlap these two perspectives as much as possible. But we need to remember, for the naval architect, for the builder, for the shipyard, the pot, the ship, for the owner, but the owner of the cargo vessel, he's interesting how much the vessel can carry, how much will be the cost of carriage. For the owner of the leisure boat, important is really the leisure, how much wind he or she will have in the face. For the owner of a super yacht, it will be more important probably to go outside in the world with his friends, with his pairs. And eventually when they come, I learned it, that situations like this are possible. When they come from the scuba diving, he will be able to say, look, my yacht is that one because the stern tube is shining. For the other ones, the stern tube is not shining.
So because you've done surveys, right? And that's obviously part of like the whole process. I found it interesting that marine surveyors ultimately were born out of the idea that when people were doing the initial trade routes and all of that, you didn't know what quality of boat was going to be transporting anything. And by creating this job role of maritime surveyor, it greatly increased how much trade was actually like passed around through the countries. And insured all of these merchants.
Okay, let's discuss about the nice story of Mr. Lloyd. Lloyd's. Because this is the answer for you, honestly. Mr. Lloyd apparently had a coffee shop, not a tea shop, in London, on Thames, on the Thames shores. And because it was very fanciful, all of this, he had a lot of customers from... Yeah, you can imagine Thames, there were a lot of merchandisers and a lot of owners, captains, and so on. And Mr. Lloyd apparently was a person who listened a lot. And at a certain point, he started to cross some dots. And I imagine himself maybe advising some friends, telling them that he heard that maybe that boat is not so trustful, or maybe the crew or the captain has a drink problem, or maybe something dodgy with the cargo, you see, things like this. At a certain point, Mr. Lloyd started to make some nice money by consulting in this way. What is cool? Nothing to say. Okay, things was that Mr. Lloyd died. Everybody died. Yeah, you see. But after a while, the industry start to feel to miss him. And apparently, a group of entrepreneurs decided that they need an entity to do what Mr. Lloyd did, like one person. This is the funny thing, you see. And in this moment, that first association was established, and this first association started to do the same thing, to gather information, you see, to give consultation, and they start to classify the ships, and they start to register, so to register ships, and in the register to classify the ships, or to have eventually different, I don't know exactly, these are, you can imagine, but they start to register and classify. And their main function initially was for the insurer, but also for the person, for the merchandiser, let's put like this, you see. Slowly, slowly, also the owner, they became interested to prove
the value of the boat, yeah.
The value of the boat, the fact that the boat is safe, that they want to sink it in the middle of the ocean and take the insurance, or, you see, a lot of things could happen, yeah. The business developed and helped the industrial development of the Great Britain. Apparently, this was very much observed by other nation on the brink of the industrialization. And this is, in my opinion, is the key word, industrialization. Here, it's about the history. So hence, the next one, guess what? The next similar association was founded in the French influence area. If I remember well, it was really founded in Belgium, but Belgium, you know, it was under the big influence, Napoleon time and things like that. So something 1821 or something like this, you see, and it was the Bureau Veritas, the next one. But what I want to stress, it was the next nation what was very due for industrialization. The Germanischer Lloyd, for example, came very late in this history, due to the fact that the German states, despite the fact that they were very, very, very much on the way to industrialization, but they were very fragmented. And Germanischer Lloyd came like entity very close to the moment when Germany was unified by Prussian Empire, you see, something like this. So it's very interesting how somebody studying the history can see that every time when an industrial country emerged, the classification society was there close. Mm-hmm. You see? This creates a very interesting thing, because I think that maritime remained the only industry where these functions and role have not been took by the authorities, by the states.
Well, I was a history major in college, and I absolutely love hearing a maritime history.
Yeah.
Just looking to the present then, what do you, you know, how do you view the state of the maritime industry today?
So on a very top view, without going in the details of crisis and things like that, I want to tell you one thing. Maritime industry, by definition, it's a very conservative industry.
Mm-hmm.
But from time to time, there are some kind of pushes for modernization.
Yeah.
So it was the matter about the steel hull. It was the matter about steam, diesel. Things like this. I think that indeed we are now on the... I would say that we are more than on the brink. I think that we are on the way to go deeply in a modernization process.
Yeah.
This modernization process, I think, is driven by definitely by digitization, but it's also driven, in my opinion, and so I'm afraid that digitization is accepted and recognized by everybody like a drive for all of this. But personally, I think that it's a drive there in a change of philosophy due to the impact of the offshore. Right. For me, the offshore industry is just the newest branch of the maritime industry. The maritime industry, in my opinion, has the traditional transport, the new one, the offshore industry, but they are both maritime. This is the way how I thought. And the offshore industry came with a new philosophy, what is very much risk-based, what is fundamentally different from the classic traditional prescriptive-based logic of the classic maritime of the transport. The risk-based philosophy, in my personal opinion, is good because can accelerate the transformation and adopting the new.
So do you think that the maritime industry can learn from this kind of offshore element then as a consequence? Because as you say, the philosophies are different.
I think that both the offshore can learn from the classic transport. Yes. And the maritime could learn from offshore. And the funny thing is that probably I'm one of, I apologize, I don't want to put myself on spotlight or something like this, but
we're putting you on the spotlight by interviewing you. It's okay.
You're right.
You're already there.
Yeah, indeed. So let's not waste the chance. Yeah. When I came in Aberdeen in 2007, I was very shippy. You see, so the people here told me this, you are very shippy, because I had experience in oil tanker, in container vessels, in bulk dry cargo vessel, bulk cargo and so on, bulk carriers. But when I came here and I start to tell them to various people, okay, me to tell, but to people working in this industry for years and years and years, and I start to tell them, no, you should not do this. This is completely wrong. This is a blasphemy or something like this. And people were, you see, we are doing this for years and years and years. Nothing special happens. So what are you telling us, you see?
Yeah.
And that was a pain for me, adjusting from shippy to oilet. It was a pain. I'm proud now that I adjusted myself, in my opinion, quite successfully. But I want to say that in this moment, I don't consider myself any more shippy, not oiled.
No, you can't fully lose the shippy element. No. It stays with you, doesn't it? Meryl, how shippy are you, do you think?
Who, me?
Yeah, are you shippy?
Well, the first time I ever really started reading about oil rigs was before this interview, which was fascinating. I didn't realize how you had a document in which you talked about kind of the depths of some of these oil rigs.
Yeah.
And one of them was like 7,000 feet. And I was like reading this while I was on like a 32-foot story building. And I was like, okay, this is 400-foot view. And then I'm like, oh my God, I don't even know how humans have been able to create such things.
Yeah. Though I am going to have to Google what 700 feet is, because I don't know.
Or no, 7,000 feet.
7,000 feet is how many meters?
3,000 meters. 3 kilometers.
There we go. Thank you.
Yeah. Something like this, but or two, I think two something, two between 3 and 3 kilometers. But yeah, but coming back, so I think both industry could learn from each other, and I think in a certain way they are doing. And for example, I think that this is the magic of what I try now to do, and I think this is the magic of the offshore construction, for example, because it's combining these two aspects, you see. And in general, the society has to understand that if we want to expand into the sea and oceans, we need ships like working platforms.
Definitely.
So these ships are not anymore scratching the sea or the ocean from A to B. They are going from A, because this is a funny, because from authority point of view, for example, a voyage is going from A to B, and from point of view of international convention and things like that. But it's a very good question. If an offshore vessel starts from Aberdeen, goes in the field and comes back in Aberdeen, is this a voyage? Because doesn't match the definition in the IMO documents for ships. And we need to understand that these OSV vessels, for example, are working platforms. And today could carry something for laying cable. Tomorrow can do a well intervention. The next day maybe could install something for wind turbines. Next day could launch ROV or other unmanned survey devices. It's an amazing versatility there.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like there is just so much opportunity in the space as all these revolutionary things start to come around. So what tips would you give, you know, a younger person that is potentially looking at trying to make an impact in the world? Like, what advice would you give?
a young person willing to take this profession. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. First of all, I tell to this young person to realize that we are now in the same situation what was in the 19th century, pretty much after the gold rush, or after Livingstone and Stevenson have explored and charted, I don't know, continents, unknown continents.
Mm-hmm.
Because in my personal opinion, what the oil and gas company, they did by this so-called offshore oil and gas, accepting the fact that they took out the oil and the gas, what are pretty much equivalent to the gold nuggets. What they did also, they really mapped the territory. They really got a much better understanding of what is there and what are the possibilities.
Yeah.
And by this comparison, I will ask somebody, okay, you know that California, and you know better, Marilyn, California was a big gold rush about 1850. Yeah. But now when we talk about California, in what terms are we talking? Are we talking in terms of gold nuggets? No.
Mm.
You see? And everybody wants to be in California, you know? So, or at least a big part of a big chunk of the population want to be there, what will be difficult because it's large, but not so large. And coming back, so it's the same situation in my opinion. If that person, what has the future in front of him, want to be part of something, what in my opinion will be equivalent with the development of California, you see, and maybe to be his or her child, you see, to be maybe citizen of California, if you want to say something similar, he or she need to jump in.
In terms of, so we've obviously talked a little bit about this in terms of the fact the world's a little bit complicated at the moment. I don't know if anyone's noticed, but in terms of, you know, fuel and energy has never been in the news as much as it is at the moment. What do you see, you know, as the kind of future, the fuel of the future for maritime and maybe more broadly? What do you think about all that?
I'm a big fan of nuclear. Okay. But nuclear requires a lot of wisdom, a general wisdom. What maybe like species we don't have yet, and it's sad to say this, or maybe in order to have this wisdom, we need also a more equal prosperity. Yes. For more people. And definitely the electric, but probably in the form of fuel cells, or even the hydrogen in more classic formats, will be something. As a colleague of mine told me very wisely, we are in a moment now when nothing is clear and we should not refuse any experiment, any option.
Yeah.
We are pretty much like Edison, willing to sort out the trouble of the bulb, you know, with the filament, what was still, yeah, continuing to burst and burst and burst. We're pretty much like Edison, maybe in a little bit better position than Edison was.
Okay.
When we need to continuing searching and studying. The funny thing is that probably the bottom line might be indeed electricity in various formats. You see, recently I learned it again that China want to play the same big experiment like UK want to play and take solar photovoltaic in space, because having that photovoltaic panels in space will gather pretty much the entire energy of the sun on that surface. You see, what will be huge in my opinion, and won't have problem of dust or other dirt on all of this. And after this, in a way to microwave it on the earth.
Uh-oh.
You see? Yes. So as my colleague says, if you can imagine flying fried chicken, you see, falling from sky, that will be the case. But you should wait until you should not open the microwave door until
this sounds like some weird dream I had. After spending too much time at KFC, I don't know what you guys have over there, but
you see. But the funny thing is that this is exactly, this subject was discussed in few science fiction books. And
What are your favorite science fiction books that discuss this?
Not really. They were good books, but when I'm looking to a science fiction book, I'm I'm looking to things a little bit. Let's put like this. This was in a way a little bit too narrow on some facts, on some issues or something like this. You see, when I discuss about really a science fiction book, what I will read it and read it again, I'm talking about Dune or Asimov Foundation or Frank Herbert's Dune or... in this part of the books, you see. But coming back, I think that the bottom line here that we are still exploring and it's not clear for us what is the right direction. I'm not such a big fan of what is called biofuel in this moment, excepting that the biofuel could be somehow done from a biomass what is not really essentially for food, you see, in a way or other. Because there are some papers again saying about biofuel made from alga or from kelp or something like this.
Yes, yeah, I've read about this.
But on the other hand, other papers are saying that alga or kelp could be very useful, for example, for feeding. They says that if cows will be fed with kelp, probably they will not damage the environment by their guesses. You see, I'm not a specialist. On the limit of fun, all of this. You see.
I mean, the thing is, all of this is just... I mean, I don't know how you feel listening to it, Meryl, but it's all just so, you know, there's just so many different possibilities. And, it, you know, I think the kind of uncertainty around, oh, we're not quite sure what the future is going to look like. Oh, it could be this. It could be that. There's so many different options. It's actually, you know, and verging on the world of realm of science fiction, it's actually quite an exciting space for young people to be kind of entering this world and entering this whole sphere, because it isn't clear quite how the future will look or how we'll power our vehicles. And on the one hand, that's quite unnerving, because as human beings, you know, we like certainty. But on the other hand, it is an exciting time to enter the space, because, you know, if you can dream up the idea of, you know, floating fried chicken or, you know, whatever, then maybe we can make it into reality. And actually, one of the things that struck me was this talk of floating cities. Can we go into that a little bit? What would be in your kind of dream floating city? How would you design it and what would be there?
I think that the idea of a huge pie, what pretty much I think it was what Jules Verne says in the float in the propelled island or island with propeller. You see, I don't know exactly how to translate in English or how it will be, but I think that one is not exactly the most viable idea. Also technically, also economically, from many reasons. Personally, I think that much more a kind of modular design. You see, what can assembly and disassembly depending on the depending not only on the environmental condition, for example, for facing a storm, but maybe also for social conditions, you see, or economical condition. You see, because human aggregation could be also due to these reasons. My gut feeling is that something will be more viable. And definitely for the beginning, building small units will be far more viable. We are, in my personal opinion, we are heading slowly in this direction. Not to say, for example, that the big cruisers are pretty much floating cities, but floating cities what are pretty much not sustainable in long run. You see, they are producing, but they are producing in another logic, you see, maybe on the shore logic rather than in the in their own sustainable logic. So I think that one of the key elements there, it's also to answer what is the plus value of the floating city, let's say, what the floating city brings to himself, to itself, to the people living there, and also to the overall society and economy, you see.
Yeah.
From this point of view, for example, I had a crazy thought that, for example, floating cities could be a crazy solution for various groups of people searching independence or searching a land of themselves. God knows. But I think that, for example, a rig, in a way, it's a floating city. What in a way could be sustainable in my personal opinion, because it's producing a kind of plus value. But when people will decide really to live there, not only to take helicopters back and forth, it will be the first step. And the next step will be when the first kids will be born there, and yeah, that kids will leave their childhood and their teenager there. Because what I discovered, because yes, as Romanian living in Aberdeen, I see something about these communities what have been severed from their native places. But I see that the kids what are born and raised here, despite that they are in the in a foreign community, let's go like this, they feel themselves much more connected to the local place than their parents. Yes. So I think that the first generation of kids what really have been will be born, or not necessarily born, but raised, they will have their childhood and their teenager time on such a, let's say, rig, let's call it like rig or floating, yeah, city. They will be the ones, the first real citizen population of that one. So imagine that such a kid is going to university on land and discuss with a girl what he think that might be his lover, you see, and start to tell story about how could be the sunset there, or how, yeah, he went to in the summer days to swim nearby, the for the other person will be completely, wow, what are you telling, yeah, me, yeah, here.
I mean, the thing is, the skeptic in me thinks, well, we've done a fine job of looking after the earth, haven't we? What's to say that we're going to do any better with these floating cities? I mean, that's sort of how I feel about, you know, this idea of, you know, colonizing other planets as well. We don't have the best track record. How do we know that humanity will learn and not just mess it up like we have with everything else? Just an optimistic take.
I don't think that we have other chance. Again, discussing with another colleague of mine, a good option will be moderation. I think that anyhow it's a good option. But for example, the real problem will be the demographic limitation. So just to request people to limit themselves to two children, eventually by exception three, because in reality you need a rate of 2.1, if I remember well,
yes.
For keeping at two, the population is still going down. Yes. So, but the question, it's exactly like in Ender Game, if you know the book, what another science fiction book, what I'm insisting to, it was the first science fiction book what my wife really appreciated and opened her taste for science fiction. What is not exactly so ample like my taste, but now she has a taste for science fiction. This is clear for me. And from this point of view, for example, the question is, what if the third or the fourth children will be will have a huge contribution to humankind? What if by limiting the birth, we stop the genetic combinations and humanity will miss really something?
So going into kind of going back a little bit, you know, I've heard that everyone's talking about like space, and then they're like, oh, well, I forgot what type of percentage it was, like, oh, you know, most of the ocean is like completely unknown. How unknown is the ocean?
Very unknown. Very unknown. It's, there were people saying that we know better, we've mapped better Mars than the bottom of the ocean. Simple because there were some state agencies interested to send satellites and map Mars, but they were not apparently so interested to map the sea bottom. But don't worry, I think that the Chinese are really working on this, you see. And but there are also companies what are targeting now deep sea mining. You see, what I bet that they are doing a lot of, they are charting really the territory. And as I told you also, I think the oil and gas company, they know much more simple because they operate there and they have a lot of tools for doing this. So, but again, there are other ideas saying that going to the bottom of the oceans could be an excellent training for going extraterrestrial. Because from this point of view, the risks the bottom line of the risk is the same. So it doesn't matter if a crack is somewhere in cosmos, in extraterrestrial, or a crack is somewhere on the protection on the sea bottom, the bottom line is dying, is the same. So in cosmos, it's the lack of pressure on the bottom is too much pressure.
Yeah.
So in a way, you see, people are saying that if we are mastering to work, eventually to live there, we will be able, it will be an excellent training for doing this also extraterrestrial.
And easier to easier to organize as well. So I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm actually... planning to build my own oil rig. I'm not really, but say I was, where should I do that? Where's the best place for me to build my oil rig?
In a way, you see, it's a matter of looking to what shipyards have still have experience of doing this, you see, and after this, entering in discussions with the shipyards and see what are the best offers. But again, there are many criteria to be discussed here. I really don't know what to say, because when I was in my first part of my career, not only I was shippy, but I was very much in contact with shipyards. Now moving here in Aberdeen, I get definitely more oiled, but I lost the contact really with the shipbuilding industry. And I start to have a lot of contact, let's say, with the end users. We can call it like them, operators or end users of ships, rigs, equipments, and so on. It's a complicated story, but it's clear for me that the shipyard, in my opinion, is not exactly a national project. But I will say that it's very close to a national project. And South Korea, for example, had shipbuilding as one of their five pillars for the development of the country. So some time ago, I don't know when was the 80s or 1980s or 1990s, I understood that some politician, high top politician from South Korea decided that country need to be developed. And they put it together a strategy for development. And again, I repeat, apparently they had something like five pillars for developing the country. And one was shipbuilding. And if one stage and analyze, we'll understand that shipbuilding has a lot of horizontal or transversal implication in the entire industries. Because a ship or a rig, it's a world per se. It's definitively more complex than a car. It's definitively more complex than a train. And it's really a small piece of world. And for this reason, we need so many industries and so many knowledges and so many input from the industries for building a ship. Okay, simpler is the ship, less input we have. We need, you see, more complex, more input we have. You see, like this industrial ships, especially for offshore or for an LNG transport ship, what it's an amazingly complex ship, and so on and so on. So in my personal opinion, this really was lost in the vision of many governments. And to understand that having units, economical units, capable to build a ship, it's really a very good indication of how good is their economy.
So where else do you see developing in the world in this respect? Where do you think the growth will be, if you could make a prediction?
The rule that things were moving to east, I think, happens also here. And now probably the giants are South Korea and China when it comes about shipbuilding, for example. You see, with Singapore, especially for somewhere there, especially for the offshore constructions, you see.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what will be the pandemic shock and the realization of many governments that something happens. I cannot see in states something special about commercial shipbuilding. I see a lot of effort or a lot of news about Navy shipbuilding. But definitively, for example, UK came apparently with a plan to expand the shipbuilding capability from the actual pretty much Navy only to also back to commercial vessels. Why I'm saying back, because UK, what in my opinion is the country of the naval architecture, was pretty much founded here, you see, in this country. But they were all on the cutting edge of shipbuilding, maybe roughly until 1950, 1960. And something happens definitively with the Margaret Thatcher period, but in that period something happens for the entire industries, heavy industries in UK.
There was a little bit of political fallout, wasn't there? Before my time, but I do know about it.
What happens there has consequences now. Not necessarily in the production, but I will say in the skilled workforce. It's clear for me that the government want to do something, but I'm quite curious what will be done. I really don't know. But if I would be them, and to be honest, I applied at a certain point because a certain consultancy commission was initiated here in UK, and it was a call for maritime and especially people with shipbuilding experience to apply for this commission. And okay, in my ingenuity, I says, okay, let's apply for this commission. Maybe I can bring something new or something valuable. I didn't, but okay, there are some big names on the list. It was not a very large list, you see. So, but for example, if I would be in that commission, I will say, guys, let's not be ashamed about recycling ships.
Yeah.
And why like this? Because in my personal opinion, recycling ships could be extraordinary workshop for automatization and robotization.
It's interesting. It's a really big topic within yachting, actually, is one of the things that people talk about is we're trying to be green, we're trying to be sustainable, but how do you dispose of your boats? Can you
especially
actually
if they are
the ship?
Especially if they are glass fiber or things
exactly.
Like this. It's exactly what happens with the big blades for the wind turbines.
Yeah.
But I think that the same discussion we have in society on even more larger scale when it's about plastic. And I understood that the person inventing pretty much the basis of the plastic, what ended up reasonable rich and his family, but he never imagined that he will bring to the world such a trouble.
Yes, exactly. He didn't know, like the chap who invented TNT or whatever it was, you don't know what you're doing until you do it, you know? You didn't realize it was going to be quite that popular when you invented it.
Now, on kind of a lighter note, before we get into talking about future of the ocean and then wrap this up, just quick thoughts on two things, and I think they fit pretty well. Number one, the Principality of Sealand, and two, the Titanic. Have you heard of the Principality of Sealand?
No. Well,
it's this.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's this oil rig.
Sovereign state. That's it.
Yeah, it's this oil rig that's right offshore, but it's far enough that it's not part of England. And
But you know that it was also an attempt for doing something like this in Italy.
And
it's a nice movie about this. Or for me, it was moving, you see, because it's sad, because a similar structure, what was built by that people, not like this, pretty much, let's say, use it, but it was existing already, you see. That one was destroyed, apparently, by the Italian Navy.
What?
Yes, the movie is very, very interesting and has connections. The law of the sea was modified in order to not allow situation like that situation in Italy. So that one had consequences in the very, very basic maritime, but it's marine or law of the sea, you see, what is really, really the very high level low of the seas. About that one, what I can tell you, it's a nice thing, to be honest, presumably is doing nothing wrong. I hope that they maintain that platform because this might be an issue. because it won't be so good that the rust will eat the foundation of the principality.
Wouldn't be ideal, would it?
Yeah. So I would say that probably considering the consequences of the story from Italy, it's more interesting than this one. Understood also this one had some troubles, some tentative to be really erased or occupied or whatever, but yeah.
Well, yeah, it's some crazy stuff. So yeah. What are your thoughts on, the quick thoughts on the Titanic? I feel like that's, you know, embedded in the history of maritime and you being a naval architect.
It's very much embedded, and probably the biggest consequence of Titanic, excepting the fact that the transverse bulkheads now are extended completely to the load line deck, is the fact that it triggered the process what led to SOLAS, what is the Convention of Life Saving at Sea, of saving of life at sea. And SOLAS, it's really, really a cornerstone of the maritime world in any form and in any format. So, but it's exactly the same situation. A human tragedy, a big tragedy, triggered the need of reglementation, of regulation. What it's good, however, there are people saying that every tragedy triggers this need, and this need add layers of complexity to this legislation. And indeed, SOLAS type legislation, it's a multi-layered legislation, very, very, very complex and complicated. From this point of view, for example, and I'm coming back to some part of our discussion about what this industry, the offshore and the transportation, can learn from each other. The Piper Alpha tragedy triggered safety case legislation here in UK. And pretty much the safety case legislation in UK was a big paradigm shift in the way how authorities and industry should look to the safety in the industry. In few words, the difference is that instead of having the authority or I don't know what convention defining for you what are the safety issues, what are the risks, it's the duty holder. So it's an unique responsible in front of the law what is doing its own best to define the risks depending on what they are doing and where they are doing things.
Interesting. So, you know, I guess kind of wrapping this up, where can people find you and hear more about your thoughts? And I know that you have Future of the Ocean. Can you tell us about that?
Future of the Ocean, it's a small initiative of... I'm the founder, let's put it like this, but I have also my wife was, I'm grateful to she that she accepted, let's say, to help me a little bit. Also my nephew. For a while, I had also some students from Greece helping me. Now I have a gentleman from state, specialist in welding. You see, I have various guests helping me with interviews with independent text and things like that. The site is like futureoftheocean.com. It's in one word, Future of the Ocean. Not very inspired, honestly, name, but this is. The intention is pretty much to provide a platform for people like us, just the people, you see, from the industry, to say something. This is because I have a feeling that many publication, or let's put the media space, it's dominated in this moment by a lot of names, or maybe not names, but roles and functions in the industry, rather than really voices. And I says that the normal person could have something very interesting to say as well. And democracy should work like this, you see. So Agora should be a place where not only the king or the minister or the, I don't know what, the very wealthy person will be allowed to say something. We need also the voice of the regular person to say something.
The workers. Yes. And you know, that kind of chimes with what we're doing as well, you know, with this podcast. Obviously, everyone we get on is fab in their own way. But yeah, we want to have lots of different voices and lots of different perspectives from the industry. Isn't that right, Meryl?
Of course.
Yeah. And the other place what probably is more accessible, it's LinkedIn, when I'm doing my best to manage two groups. The maritime group and the shipbuilding industry and professional.
We totally didn't bring up how you are the admin of one of the largest maritime groups on LinkedIn.
Wow, that sounds hard work.
I think, it's a lot of passion built in there. You see, so when somebody is doing something with passion, probably the hard work, it's put it a little bit aside, or the concept of hard work. But yes, probably my wife will agree very much with you, Georgia. You see, she will say, yes, it's a lot of hard work and time, what you steal from me.
Yes. Do you get shouted at and told to get off your phone by any chance?
Yeah, and maybe computer. I was saying, but I try also to build there some communities what are let's say more orientated let's say to general discussions. It's interesting for me to observe there how shy is the regular professional, because I don't have no other conclusion that people are shy in general. I doubt that they really don't have something to discuss or to say. And I ended up with these two groups pretty much doing what now looks like a reader digest. The funny thing is that my first contact, and for a while the only contact with a reader digest type publication, was the Soviet Sputnik. See, because if you remember, I was born and raised in communist time and era, you see. So and now looking to what happens there, I can see that something like this happens. It's a kind of reader digest. My wife told me, yes, it's normal that people will enter and will want to stay there, because you and few another ones, you are just serving them with a summary of the best of a very selected set of news of the day. So yeah, it's normal that instead of browsing I don't know how many publications, they are going in your groups and they are just reading the news there. Yes. Or the essential or the most important news. But to be honest, not this was my intention. And when I'm continuing to post things there, every time when I do this, I hope, I pray that this will trigger a discussion.
Awesome, Marius. Well, it was amazing to, you know, hear all these thoughts and give a unique perspective that you don't really get to hear too often, especially in my industry. Yeah, recreational leisure marine.
Thank you so much. I feel my brain is fizzing with flying chickens and underwater cities and off where I'm going to plan my next oil rig. Just a lot to think about, isn't there?
Hopefully, yes. Yes.
Thank you so much for giving us all your insights. I've learned a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure. My pleasure.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode. And be sure to like, share, and subscribe to Shipshape.pro.